traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to MerckResearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode. All right, here with Sean Feiler, President and Chief Investment Officer of Equinox Partners. And your specialty is precious metals miners. Now, this is a sector that is perhaps not quite as hip as many of the other parts of the market nowadays. If you look at growth stocks, tech stocks, digital currencies, SPACs, who knows what else. Nevertheless, silver has had quite a run up here, gold less so, but you go one derivative further and you invest in the miners of these metals, of these precious metals. But let's start and just kind of discuss the case, which is quite contrarian, which is why I wanted to have you on the podcast, for investing in this sector in the first place.
Well, Nathaniel, thank you for having me. Basically, I think in a nutshell, the case for gold and silver mining companies today is that's a sector that is cheap when everything else, almost all financial assets are expensive.
Right.
And you lay on top of that the macro geopolitical backdrop, which I think is very positive for the underlying commodities, gold and silver, that these companies are producing. And you have an unloved sector where you can buy companies with 20% free cash flow yields at today's prices with, you know, a lot of inefficiency in the sector overlaid on that absolute level of low valuation. So it just really sets up, I think, really well for value investors and for investors able to do the company specific work in the space.
All right, let's talk about the underlying macro scenario first a little bit. You have a Fed and central banks around the world that are very accommodative, to put it mildly, printing money, which typically speaks well to precious metals. And I mentioned the rally in silver at the outset. Gold hasn't really followed, but what else is there that is kind of underlying the case for precious metals?
Well, we've kind of breached all sorts of historical norms in financial markets over the last 10 years. And so it's hard to not be a nerd to just the financial reality that we see every day in terms of whether it's fiscal or monetary policy. But you had you know, a federal government last year in the United States that spent almost twice what it took in revenues. Ostensibly, things are getting better in the economy, but despite that, we're now proposing to spend significantly more in fiscal 2021 than we did in 20, and the deficit's actually going to increase. And rather than normalizing, we have a Fed that's still buying $120 billion worth of assets every month. And so you have a compounding of fiscal and monetary policy that's totally unprecedented with any kind of economic recovery. And the idea that gold and silver wouldn't do well in that environment, I think, would be totally at odds with financial history. And the fact that they're not higher today than they already are is, I think, a little surprising. And the fact that the miners are as cheap as they are is, you know, even more surprising.
Do you have any theories on maybe why they aren't as high as they are?
I think you kind of started with this in your intro. I think people that had some of the macroeconomic and geopolitical biases that I have been wrong for 10 years. So the gold and silver mining stocks are off 65% from their 2011 peak as of today. So you've had this very long bear market at a time when investors have made money in just about every other financial asset, whether it's the tech stocks or the indices or fixed income. And so the idea that you would stop owning the things that have worked so well for you for 10 years and go buy a unloved sector where you don't really maybe know the companies that well, I think is not, we see more investors looking, more sophisticated investors looking, but really just not pulling the trigger given, I think, the returns they're still making elsewhere.
Fair enough. Now, we mentioned gold and silver. Obviously, there are other precious metals, and we've just been throwing them together. Do you have any views on any others? The platinum comes to mind.
No, we're really interested in the monetary metals for their, you know, monetary features. Obviously, that's gold. Gold, unlike the other metals, is not used. And so almost all the gold ever produced is above ground and deliverable in some form at some price, which is why historically gold has been money. And then silver has an extraordinarily high correlation to gold. It tends to be much more volatile than gold because unlike gold, silver is actually consumed. And so the stocks of silver available are, you know, it's $100 billion of silver that's deliverable, 2 or 3 years of supply, something like that, maybe 3.5 years of supply. Whereas gold, it's $15 trillion worth of gold deliverable. So they're just very different markets. They're going to be highly correlated with silver being a lot more volatile.
Interesting. Now, talk to me about why the miners specifically, as opposed to just buying the metal or futures of the metal, I guess.
So you can buy the metal, you can pay $1,800 and buy an ounce of gold or $27 and buy an ounce of silver. Silver, the premiums now to get the actual physical are very high. And so there's incremental issue in terms of execution in buying the metal. But in the case of gold, you can buy, you know, a company like Endeavor, which is 1.5 million ounce producer, one of the 10 largest companies in the world. And you're paying basically $200 for an economic ounce in the ground. So you're buying a small fraction of what you would pay to buy the metal, and then that metal comes to you at a all-in sustaining cost of less than $1,000 over the next 20 years. And so you get more upside to higher metal prices over time, and you have an initial cost that you're paying for each ounce produced. And so I think that just creates an opportunity to generate a lot of value even in sideways metal prices. And if metal prices go up, you get a lot more leverage to the underlying metal price than you would if you just bought the metal itself.
Very interesting. All right. And okay.
Well, you know, the one thing that is worth pointing out is that the most of the flows into the space, and if you look at the last 2 years and use the ETFs for the mining companies, gold and silver mining companies, as a proxy for flows into the space, which is pretty good, you've had almost no flows into gold and silver mining over the last 2 years. And certainly some outflows this year with the GDXJ down 11% for the year to date. You have had inflows and meaningful inflows into the metal, into gold and silver itself and through the ETFs. What I find really curious is that those flows are going through ETFs where the custodian is HSBC, which is now, you know, increasingly a Chinese bank. It trades at less than book, and it just, it's not a consistent way to want to own the underlying metal is to have it filtered through that kind of counterparty. And so I think people get the general idea, and I think the way in which they're executing their metal ownership and then not executing, generally speaking, the ownership of the mines is the real opportunity for value creation.
I see. So these ETFs, the GLD comes to mind. It's probably the most widely cited.
Yeah.
It's almost cited as a proxy, but they don't actually own physical gold, do they? Or how does that work?
Well, so they do. The question is, do they only own physical gold or do they own some other claims on the metal? And that's a long and intricate debate. I think the bigger issue is whether or not you would want HSBC to be your custodian. It's not immediately obvious to me that they would be, that would be the institution you would pick to be the intermediary between your ownership of the underlying metal via the ETF, via the capital markets.
Interesting.
And you're starting to see, in the case of silver, you're starting to see some price divergence between the Sprott ETFs and some of the other ETFs. And so there's been a really robust debate online over the last month about exactly how much wiggle room do the ETFs have in terms of ownership of claims on the underlying metal versus the actual underlying metal. And you're starting to see in the way the market's pricing those ETFs, especially in the silver market now, it's been about a 4% divergence over the last month in terms of the preference the market is showing for the Sprott ETF versus the alternatives in the market.
Okay.
So I think that's also interesting and is showing, I think, some recognition on the part of the market that there is, certainly in the case of silver, there's a potential for some scarcity of the actual metal. And you see that now in certainly in the coin market, where you're paying these big premiums for the metal.
Interesting. So yeah, so to your point, rather than, if you're going to own an asset that's kind of a proxy for the metal, why bother with the ETF when you get a miner that has actual underlying assets and that is more probably correlated to it anyway?
So the issue with owning the miner is now you have jurisdiction risk, you have operating risk, right. You have governance risk. So you have a lot of idiosyncratic factors in each of the mining companies that you don't have in the metal.
Okay.
And given the long bear market, most investors aren't familiar with these companies and aren't really in a position to do the due diligence on the C-suite and the board, and let alone the assets, especially during COVID when you can't go and you can't do the site visits that easily. Yeah. And so it's a challenge for active managers to go and figure out which of these companies they want to own. Yeah. So I think that's been a little of the barrier. I think that is a important opportunity to create value as an active manager. I think there's a separate issue when it comes to the decision to own the metal itself. If you're owning something, a financial asset that's very much the opposite of other financial assets, you probably want to do it with certainty of custody and maybe probably not filtered through the stock market, given that it is really opposed in a lot of ways to what we're seeing in terms of conventional monetary fiscal policy and the overvaluation of financial assets we're seeing more generally.
Got it. Okay, cool. All right, Sean Feiler, thank you for joining the Contrarian Podcast. I want to come back and ask you some more about this and about the expertise that your actual fund has in this sector, and also get some of your favorite stock picks. But let's first take a short break. If you are a premium subscriber, you do not get the break, so don't go anywhere. Don't touch the dial. And to become a premium subscriber, visit the site contrarian.supercast.tech and sign up. I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarize the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merkresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Sean Feiler of Equinox Partners. This is the segment of the show where we talk a little bit about our guest tells us a little bit about his background, how he came to his current station in life, how he came to investing in the first place, and all of that. So why don't you take it away and fill us in on those details?
Well, this should be painlessly short. I got an internship in 1994 at Equinox Partners, joined as an analyst in 95, and now I'm the president, CIO, I guess it's 26, 27 years later now. Wow. So only ever where really been one place. Basically, we invest, most of our assets are in gold and silver mining. We also do EM and frontier market investing. And so we're really able to look at the jurisdictions in which we're invested from a variety of different vantage points. And basically the work of getting to know the countries, the politics, the macroeconomic backdrop, even in many cases in mining, it's the local jurisdiction and social issues are amongst the most important things to understand. Mm. And basically doing that on a global basis for 20 plus years now has been really interesting and really stimulating. Obviously, we've been through some meaningful bull and bear markets, but that's basically my career in a nutshell.
Wow. That's wild. I don't think I've ever interviewed somebody who's been at the same place his or her entire career since 94, no less.
Yeah.
You mentioned the jurisdictional issues. Now, these gold miners are, I mean, they're all over the world. I know Canada has some, the US has some, there's some in Africa. Are there any particular jurisdictions that you guys focus on or that you rule out for political issues or anything, any other reason?
You know, so the countries where it's all about politics are not countries we're active in. So whether it's you know, Guinea or Venezuela, or you could put, there's a long list of countries that are basically just about the politics. I'd say the kind of big stylized fact that is obvious to us, and I think maybe a lot of people in the space, but not to EM investors, even or frontier market investors, is that West Africa has really been a good place to build a mine for 20 years. Mm. And Latin America has been a difficult place and on average in most countries has gotten more difficult as a jurisdiction. And there's lots of variation, obviously, country to country, both in West Africa and in Latin America. But we find some of the local social issues in Latin America tend to be less soluble, more persistent, more idiosyncratic. Whereas in West Africa, there's a lot of headline risk, but we find by and large, the projects tend to go ahead and the governments tend to stick to the deal that you've inked with them, which is by and large has not been our experience in Latin America.
Mm. So you're basically saying that Latin America is even more corrupt than Western Africa. No, I'm joking.
It's just different, right? So, some of the West African countries, right, the business of the country is mining. And sure. So I'm not saying that their incentive structures are different than what you see in Latin America. And then the ways in which NGOs operate and the ways in which communities politicize mines is just different. So in Guatemala, we've been invested over the last decade in a mine that was built, the Escobal mine, operated. They have $3 billion of copper underground. It's a great mine and it's now been shut down for years, having to do with local politics and local indigenous communities and It's just not something that we see. We don't see that kind of behavior in West Africa. Mm-hmm. And here I'm thinking about Ghana, the Ivory Coast, Mali, Burkina Faso. There's other, okay. you can find a country in West Africa where you can have a problem. And Kinross has had some problems in Mauritania. There's been problems, but it's not the same types of community problems that we've consistently seen in Latin America.
I'm wondering, do you have any, since you guys do EM as well, and frontier markets, do you have any views on any of these African countries as far as just the investment in the, call it maybe the equity market or something? I know that, you know, Nigeria has an ETF, has for some time, and I don't know of any other Western African countries that do, but they do have investable assets in some way. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, they have. I mean, they have some very small capital markets. Right. Generally speaking, Frontier has been through a huge cycle. Yeah. So you've had massive outflows out of the space, no buyers. And so stocks in many of these Frontier markets at unbelievably low valuation. Mm. So Ghana is a good example where you've had kind of a mix of middling to bad macroeconomic policy and some local brokerage houses that went bankrupt, investors having lost money locally, frontier markets having redeemed. And so you can, you know, buy your average Ghanaian stock, which more or less nobody wants to do because the currency is also not exactly something that you want to own. But you can buy it at a mid-single digit multiple to earnings, sometimes high single digit multiple to earnings, depending on exactly what you want to own. There's just not much market for those securities either globally or domestically. Yeah. So I think there's a good opportunity there. What we see is just being able to look at the local banks from the vantage point of the local capital markets, or look at the local telephone company or mobile money operator, and then also look at the mining company in that same jurisdiction. It just gives us a more rounded view than what we would get if we only looked at that jurisdiction from the perspective of mining investments. And so it's been a real, I think over time, been a help to us.
All right. So let's talk then about some of these specific companies. You mentioned Endeavor at the outset. Now, is that Endeavor Silver Corp or?
No, this is Endeavor Mining. So it's they produce 1.5 million ounces. They will in 2021, which makes them a top 10 producer in the world. If you look at their share registry, it's really amazing. Only about 5% of their shares are owned by retail. And so despite being really a scale operator, it's not something that people, not a company people talk about or know. The two things that we've really liked there is we've liked the large insider ownership. So Naguib Suarez now owns through his holding company a high teens percentage of this company. And so we haven't had in Endeavor some of the same agency issues we've seen in other gold and silver mining companies. He's very aligned with the minority shareholders, and that's created, I think, from a capital allocation perspective and execution perspective, better operations really over the last decade. The other thing is that they're basically doing what I think on a smaller scale, what Mark Bistro did in West Africa when he built Randgold. And that's basically this 20-year opportunity in West Africa where you could identify a resource, get a permit, build a mine on time, on budget, and generate actual meaningful amounts of free cash flow from that undertaking, which has not been true in much of the world. And they're basically, I see them as following in those footsteps and really operating at a very high level.
EDVMF is the OTC ticker.
Yeah, EDV is the Canadian.
Oh, there's the Canadian listing also.
So it's a $5 billion U.S. Yeah. market cap company.
Right. Shares have been roughly flat over the last year, down 1.6%. So, you know, they had a dip, the COVID dip with everybody else, but have not rebounded as much as, you know, other sectors. And now I see here that they're starting a dividend payment.
Yeah, I think they pay just under 2%. The free cash flow yield here is very substantial, well into the high teens at current metal prices. I think the thing maybe to think about just in the last year is they've consummated in the last 12 months two really significant deals. So in March of last year, when everybody was thinking about something else other than doing M&A, they were able to buy Semafo. So they were able to pick up the Bongo asset in Burkina at very attractive prices, given when they did the deal. They were the chosen acquirer, I think, really on the part of the government of Burkina. And that was an asset that had been shut down for security reasons, and they were able to come in and make a really accretive acquisition at a time when others couldn't act. Now they follow that up with the acquisition of Teranga, which is closing shortly. And I think that's also another low premium, accretive deal. They'll be their balance sheet will be out of debt on a net basis at some point in 2021. And they're still trading at a discount to NAV, despite this kind of long track record of value creation. But that, I think, is just a reflection of, you know, investors are really doing something else with their money. They're just not in this space. And so even where we're talking about a $5 billion company that's a top 10 producer globally, it's not a tip of tongue name for really most investors. They just don't know what this company is or who the people are or what they're doing.
And they produce gold mostly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay. Any other stocks that we can talk about?
At the other end of the spectrum in terms of market cap. So we own companies that are as small as $100 million. We own a company called RTG Mining. It operates, its principal asset that they're developing is in the Philippines. And this, where you'd pay $200 an ounce for an ounce in the ground in the case of Endeavor, here you'd pay $10 an ounce if they can actually produce the ounces and get all the licenses that they need and the offtake agreements and build the processing facilities. And so they have a long path ahead of them to actually generating cash flow, but you're able to buy what are, geologically speaking, economic ounces in the ground at a fraction of even what you pay at Endeavor. So that's a company where we had an investment going back a couple years. We knew the team from an asset that developed in the Philippines going back a decade ago that they sold to B2 Gold, the Masbate mine in the Philippines. And so we've seen them do the right things for a decade, had an opportunity to put more capital in last year, and really like the team, like the assets, and you know, love the valuation there. And so that's an example of kind of, if you're willing to go, you know, very microcap, the kind of valuations you can get in today's market.
And it says here they explore for copper as well as gold.
So they have their two principal assets are both copper and gold. Those geologically two metals tend to be associated with each other in many cases. In the current asset that they're trying to develop in the Philippines, the initial cash flow is very heavily copper. They have a cap of an ore body that's almost 20% copper on a co-product basis. And so if you know anything about copper mining, 20% is a number that you almost never see, but it creates this opportunity to put in very little capital and really generate some meaningful returns, I think, that would cover their market cap if they could just get in place that first phase of the first asset that they have in the Philippines.
Does this trade in Canada as well?
Trades mainly in Australia, but I think it's also listed in Canada.
Right, right. There's a gray market in the US too, but it doesn't seem very liquid at all. But yeah, so that seems like an interesting kind of speculative call option type of deal. Tell me a little bit about the fund, Equinox Partners, which I assume predates the gym of the same name, right?
It does. Sometimes I'll have some people at a conference tell me how much they like my gym, and I'll usually disabuse them sometimes, just thank them. No, there's no relation with the gym. Equinox Partners was founded in 94, the year I joined as an intern. We are at this point heavily invested in gold and silver mining companies. It's the largest single sector that we have in the fund. It's not exclusively what we do. We do have dedicated accounts that are only in gold and silver mining, but the fund we invest in Frontier, EM, other assets as well, where we use basically the same approach, which is a better business value investing approach. We want a good C-suite, importantly, a good board, real good governance, and then we're looking for high returns on capital employed, rational capital allocation policies, and we're finding value, really, as you would expect in this kind of market, in spaces where just other people aren't. So whether that's now for us, principally gold and silver mining, Frontier is another example of a place where just other people aren't in today's market because you're making 30%+ a year owning tech stocks. So why would you look anywhere else? Exactly. At some point that changes, and we think the dynamics in the market we're in change as well.
Yep. And that's the why we need to be contrarian sometimes. Sean Fowler, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Podcast, Investor Podcast. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.